Morning to everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. Really, for over a year, we have been a virtual sangha. We certainly continue that. But as our members know, because I wrote you earlier in the week, we took a dramatic step earlier this week. Of course, most of you have only been on Zoom, so you haven't seen what it's like in here, but basically the meditation hall has sort of been like a TV studio. We've had our whole audiovisual setup down here, and I have been primarily looking into a camera for the past year. So because of the openings that are slowly happening in our society now, we made the move of putting our audiovisual back upstairs in the balcony, and we are beginning to invite more members to join us for Sunday meditation and perhaps for other meditations as things slowly open up. We are quite confident that we can be together safely. Our hall is large enough, and our, I would say, our members are compliant enough to follow directions, to maintain social distancing, wearing masks, etc., to observe the protocols in terms of where they've been and who they've been exposed to, so there's no risk. So I think we are confident that we can begin this reopening. But when I sent out an email to the membership about this, I did get some panicked emails saying, does that mean we're no longer going to Zoom on Sundays or other meditations? And the answer is, as you can see right now, we are continuing to Zoom. And how that plays out over the coming months, we will see. But of course, Sunday has always been a Zoom to everyone, members or non-members. So it's wonderful to see people in the hall, even though I guess the new normal is we see each other as human beings, but we are all masks. So we are just getting very good at eye reading, but hopefully that will come to an end and we'll be able to see each other full face. Before I begin my talk this morning, there's something we traditionally do. Many of us in the community know that we have a very strong core community of ordained and aspiring members of the Order of Interbeing. I won't go into it, but the Order of Interbeing is an order that was founded by Thich Nhat Hanh in Vietnam in the 60s. It has obviously grown quite a bit as his following has grown quite a bit. And it is a wonderful community of people who really want to publicly take a stand, publicly, to announce their willingness to follow the 14 trainings of the Order of Mindfulness, the Order of Order of Interbeing. So there are 14 trainings of the Order of Interbeing. We have different trainings; it gets confusing at times, Again, we have over 50 members in our community, in our larger community, we have 50 members who are in the order or aspiring to be in the order. And they make the public commitment to live an awakened life, to follow the 14 trainings, which we talk about a lot every Monday. For those who attend Monday evening meditations, we discuss them then. And the other part of their commitment is to really support community. And specifically in our community. They want to create places, oases in our society where people can come and nourish themselves with meditation and mindfulness, where they can cool themselves in the sweet rain of Dharma and the teachings. And they can be with other people who share their aspiration in this life. So it's very important that we create physical spaces and communal spaces where this can go on. It's absolutely essential because the other ways we have of changing the world, changing people, changing society, in the ultimate sense, may not be that effective without this inner transformation. And so more and more places there are where people can practice together, learn and practice together, will facilitate a really deeper and more meaningful transformation of our world, of our society. So every year we put out a call meeting certain criteria for people who are members who want to become aspirants in the Order of Interbeing. We did that again this year, and part of that process is briefly the new aspirants announcing to their community their aspiration and asking for our support. So we have some people in the hall this morning and some people on Zoom and a few people who couldn't make it for other reasons. Shall we begin with those in the hall? Begin with those in the hall. So we have David Brosh, Ms. Schaefer, and Kelly Dan in the hall. And Max, you will facilitate just bringing the microphone around.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mitch Schaefer, and it's so wonderful to be in this sacred building after 15 months. And I'm filled with gratitude for what the Dharma and our teacher has brought to me over these last few years, and very inspired to be a new aspirant in the Order of Interbeing. And one of the areas I really want to develop and grow my practice is in Sangha building and giving back and contributing to our Sangha through selfless service in the year ahead. So I look forward to that and would be grateful for any support that you can give me along the way. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is David, and I'm an aspirant in Order of Interbeing because I want to deepen my practice, and I want to continue to serve this community that has really transformed my life. You know, the 14 guidelines, or the 14 mindfulness trainings, I need them. David's guidelines don't work. And they haven't for a long, long time. And what I've realized about myself, if you give me guidelines, I will follow them the best I can, but I am lazy. So I'm asking for your support. Call me on it, right? If you see actions of body, speech, or mind, I'm getting off track, just nudge me back. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Kelly Dan, and my aspiration is to serve the community more, cultivate wholesome seeds, transform unwholesome seeds, and I ask for support from the community to practice hard and let me know if I'm off the path to be kind and gentle with your communication about that. And yeah, that's it.
I believe, Angie, you will be spotlighting them. Is that correct? We'll begin with Christine.
Dear Ty, dear Fred, and dear Sangha, my name is Christine Patasha. My aspiration is to learn more and deepen my practice with the 14 mindfulness trainings, and to support the Sangha. I ask for everyone's support in that. And also, if you see me, I'm new to the Sangha. So if you see me, please come up and introduce yourself and say hi so I can get to know everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Next is Doug Coleman. So by the way, Christine lives on the east coast of Florida, and Doug lives in Atlanta.
Hello, everyone from Atlanta, where I live. My aspiration is to follow the 14 mindfulness trainings. And I hope to discover a greater sense of belonging to the world and all of its inhabitants. I'll welcome your support as I continue this training to cultivate a spacious attitude and gentleness. So I hope to make efforts to serve the Sangha both in Tampa and my local Sangha here in Atlanta. And I look forward to visiting you next week when I'll be driving down to attend in person.
Next is John McCarris.
Dear teacher and dear Sangha. My intention as an OI aspirant is to develop a deeper practice of interbeing, both with our Sangha and with the world. More specifically, by developing my practice and my understanding of the 14 mindfulness trainings, I intend to become a living example of the trainings and to embody the Dharma. I see the Sangha as a wonderful opportunity or as a field of practice. And I ask for your support, particularly when you see me straying from these intentions.
Next is Rita Caffey, who lives in St. Petersburg. John lives in Naples. Can't hear you. Rita, you gotta unmute yourself. There you go.
Thank you. I wrote this down so that I could refer back to it and make sure that I'm on the right path and staying focused with my intentions. So my aspiration as an OI aspirant is to transform my unhealthy, unhelpful, and judgmental mind states so they can no longer hinder me from being of benefit to others and act in ways that end suffering in the world. I aspire to be more like Ty, Fred, and the Bodhisattvas here at FCM, who show us the path of themselves freely to nurture and support our Sangha and the community at large. I aspire to develop a deeper understanding of the 14 mindfulness trainings and apply their meanings to my life. I ask for support from the Sangha with my aspirations. Please share with me your insight and your experiences. Please encourage me in my aspirations. Please help me stay on the Bodhisattva path.
Thank you, Rita. And last is Spence Davis. Spence lives in Tallahassee. You're muted, Spence. Hopefully this will all be behind us one day. Probably, you know, when we finally get it down, then we won't have to do it anymore.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I've been fortunate to be part of the Buddha community of mindfulness for about 8 years now, and took the 5 mindfulness trainings many years ago. And this past year, I realized going through some very great challenges. I realized that I was reacting very differently, and maybe the Dharma rain was really starting to seep in, and perhaps I was ready to become an aspirant to the order of inner being. So I'm very grateful for all that's the amazing things that are being done here at FCM, and want to continue to contribute to that. And my aspiration is to deepen my practice and to find ways to contribute to continued growth of this great sangha. Bowing.
Thank you, Spence. And please, I think you heard from all our aspirants, and the reason they publicly do this is just for what you heard. I mean, they are stepping forward to say they will, they'll put their practice in the public view, both in terms of how they live their lives and how they live according to the principles of the 14 mindfulness trainings, but they'll also be there for us to help support us and to help support us in the many ways that they do. And so, please keep your eye on them. They ask for our help. So when we see them practicing beautifully, we should acknowledge that. But if we see they are straying, getting caught up in their historical way of responding to things, just help them, give them a gentle nudge, whatever is appropriate to help them, because they've publicly stepped forward. They want to be bodhisattvas in this life. And so bodhisattvas, they're created by meeting the challenges of life, but meeting the challenges of life in a very different way than we have historically done. So please be there for them, and I certainly will be there to offer my deep support. So, before I get into Dzogchenpa, I want to share a little bit from Dzogchenpa. Most people don't know about Dzogchenpa, that's okay. I wanted to say just a little bit, because we are in a very interesting time in our society with this whole COVID thing, and now the vaccination and masks, et cetera. And we know that there seems to be a significant part of the population that see the wearing of masks as a giving up of their freedom, right? In the same way, many of these same people, I think, see giving up their high-powered guns as an infringement on their freedom. So there is a continuum in this life between absolute personal freedom, I can do whatever I want, and we might say a more communal view that I act for the benefit of all. And that's, you can see in many societies and many political systems, that tension between personal freedom and communal responsibility varies. And we know that at the, communal responsibility could be totalitarian or something, imposed. But I think Buddhism has something to say about this. In the Mahayana, and we practice in the great path of the Mahayana, tradition of Buddhism, which is the wide path, the large path, the path where we include everyone, and the well-being, and we practice for the well-being of all. We practice for the transformation of our society. That's why we personally want to transform ourselves, awaken ourselves, so we really have the capacity to really wake up and free other people. So we practice within the well-being of all. And so our decisions, we give up making our decisions in terms of what will benefit me. We kind of do a reset from our traditional self-centered way of being to become other-centered, which means I make my decisions in terms of what will be of benefit to the many, you see, which is a very different way of even coming at political decisions or what freedom is. In Buddhism, we have a lot to say about freedom. But the freedom that Buddhism promises is not the freedom of the self that wants to do whatever it wants. Actually, in Buddhism, we think that is suffering. That is separation. And that it is moving away from that self-centered, self-centric view of life and into a life that embraces all, that sees the commonality of all, and that makes decision in terms of what will benefit others. Right? So in our desire to benefit others, we are always doing many things, right? So we do not do harm. Protect. We observe the speed limit. We drive on the right side of the road that we're supposed to drive on. I mean, you know, if you think about it, there are many things where we have given up our personal liberty, you know, right, to benefit all. Of course, it's also to benefit me. And so when it comes to these bigger societal decisions of observing the protocols that the CDC has put down for the benefit of all, right? To look at the violence in our society and the use of guns, certain kinds of guns that are highly destructive, well beyond the personal needs of a human being. We make decisions for the benefit of all, for the safety of all, for the safety of society. And I just use as an example that these are not just social political decisions, you know. These are very human. They're really about what my values are, you know. And as I say, as bodhisattvas, and I was, you know, in listening to the aspirants today, you know, they're making the vow to really give up doing harm and always to do good, which means to protect beings, even when they don't know better. You see, we have rules like these mask rules and social distancing rules. Why do we have rules? Because people on their own won't comply. This is the nature of sentient beings. I mean, many of us, we haven't progressed much beyond nursery school or kindergarten. You know, we just want to do what we want to do. And so just like, you know, in kindergarten, there is a teacher who sets down classroom rules. What's done and what's not done, how people interact, because of the nature of our complex society with so many different people, with so many different views, with so many different levels of development. You know, hopefully we have intelligent people making decisions for the benefit of our society. So here, you know, in terms of like this opening that we're doing, we're doing it, but we're doing it within the context of the CDC, Center for Disease Control, recommendations in terms of how people can be together in spaces. So in social distancing, masks, et cetera. And we will continue to observe that. Why? Because we want to protect sentient beings from harm. That is always our intention. You know, in observing people this morning, and we had a couple of transmission ceremonies earlier this week where we had many more people than we've usually had, I was struck by, it wasn't easy to calm people down to get ready for meditation. People were very excited to see each other. It's sort of like we're all coming out of, or some of us, many people have never gone into hibernation, but sort of like we're coming out of hibernation. You know, we're coming out of our individual dens, and we're looking around, and we're seeing other human beings and people we've only seen on Zoom, and it's quite wonderful to encounter each other again. But I have to acknowledge that for some, there's going to be a reluctance. I think this past year, it's very interesting. You know, we spent a lot of time over this past year talking about Yogacara, the storehouse consciousness, our mental formations. So many of us have mental formations strongly around fear, around anxiety, around worry, right? And our deepest attachment in life is to our bodies and to our existence, right? We want to live. So when we perceive that our existence is threatened, our life is threatened, for many people that brings up what? Fear, worry, anxiety, terror. So I think for many people, this past year has been motivated with a lot of those emotional states. And for some, they continue. The residues of that continue to be very present in them. It may be hard for some people to believe that one could have gone through this whole past year with all the various contradictory and developing protocols that have come down over this past year, free of any worry, anxiety. It's just, this is what they're saying, let us do the best to understand it and put it into practice. That's all. That's all. It's hard for us to imagine. I think I've told in the past, when I had, when I was talking with a Tibetan teacher several years ago who has a very significant American following, who'd been in this country for many years, we got to know each other and he trusted me. For many of you heard this, but it's worth hearing again. He said to me, I have to ask you something. For years now, my American students, they're always talking about anxiety. Fred, can you tell me, what is anxiety? He had no reference for it. And because he was kind and wanted to, be understanding to his students, he didn't want to go like, what are you talking about? So he would listen. But in his culture, they don't have any word for anxiety. They have a word for fear. And he said, if there's danger right in front of you and to be afraid, we have a word for that. But this worry, this anxiety about what might happen, what could happen, they didn't even have a word for it. Now, as an American, we may be thinking, what? Since anxiety and fear is such a predominant, right, emotion in us, both in terms of our well-being, sickness, old age, and death. That's very basic to Buddhism, the understanding of it and the accepting of it. So I think this past year, for some, has been very difficult because it really has triggered us. And so it's been very hard for us to make rational, objective decisions about how to proceed. When we're afraid, when we're anxious, our rationality is skewed. I mean, anybody's read all the research on fear, we see it's, that covers us up. fear, when we are afraid, are, we enter into the tunnel. We're all we're focused on is the object of our fear. And that's an emotional thing, that's a physiological thing, and most significantly, it's a mental thing. We kind of close down and focus. So when we're in that state, we are not open to options. We are not open to objectivity because we're being driven by emotionality. This emotionality in Buddhism is called a klesha, a covering, which means it's our mind is being covered. So I hope for all of us, we have learned something as we've kind of, part of mindfulness is to be self-aware, right? And to kind of watch ourselves over this past year, not just for the choices we've made, but to the level of our emotionality. This is very important. So we can use this past year for a real kind of learning about ourselves. Learning about, if we're honest, how much of my choices this year has been driven by significant levels of worry, fear, anxiety, terror. What is the source of that within me? Right? And I think this has been an interesting Dharma year for many people in learning about attachment to views. You might have noticed within yourself too, as well as everybody else. In the past year, we have developed a country of infectious disease experts. It has been quite amazing that people have kind of skipped getting their PhD in infectious diseases or their MD in infectious diseases or their RN in infectious. They've skipped all that and they've gone right to the media. And people are, this is the nature of this, lots of information out there, but it's been very interesting how easily people became very early on, even a year ago, became experts, and not only became experts, but were very attached to their expertise. It's kind of humorous in a certain way. But looking back again, I think a lot of that is because underneath that there was fear, anxiety. We all want to live. We don't want to get sick. We're very attached to this life. I'm not judging that. I'm just acknowledging that. And so we have to see. I think it's a good. I would hope that we would all reflect and go, yeah, if I really look back of my decision-making and choices in relationship to this year, has it really been completely absent of fear and anxiety or worry? Has it always been very clear, objective, sort of, like a good scientist would be, just looking at the data and making wise choices, making prudent choices, and how much of it has been driven by emotionality? This is our practice. We are mindful. We are self-aware. We are learning from life. We practice engaged Buddhism, right? So we're engaged in life, but we are watching ourselves. We're aware of ourselves. We know wholesome states from unwholesome states. We know the difference between a clear, objective mind that has discernment, that has clarity, that is open to seeing various viewpoints, doesn't think it has the truth, right? Which is the first of the mindfulness trainings of the Order of Interbeing, right? Or whether that has not been true. And it could be true for many people right up till today. Still very attached that we think we have the truth. We have the right view. There is no truth. There is no right view. All we can ever do is just do our best to discern in the moment, in the situation, what could be the best prudent way to proceed. And that's a good lesson for all of us in life. So I think this has been a very meaningful year in that sense, for our community, for ourselves as individual practitioners. Let me just spend a few minutes. I want to share with you, as most of you know, in our community, a central part of our ongoing practice is we do intensives, these intensive periods of of study and practice around certain subjects, certain teachings. Right now we have three different ones going on, one at the level of our mindful living path, one at the level of our Dharma path, and one at the level of wisdom path. And I am facilitating the wisdom path, and we're using a text called Dzogchenpa's Testament. And I won't go into that, saying that Dzogchenpa was a great Tibetan master over 1,000 years ago. And at the end of his life, he wrote a testament. Basically all these various admonitions, just all the things he's learned to his students about life, about practice. But he wrote them very simply, like, and there are 80 of them, and each of them have sub-characteristics. So this is a text that has his original very pithy text. It also has a kind of annotated commentary that a 19th century teacher kind of wrote down in his commentaries. And then it finally has a more elaborated commentary by Digo Chensi Rinpoche, who's a great Tibetan teacher who was practicing, and he taught widely even in the West, and he died in the 80s. So this is a wonderful text, and this is the focus of study and practice for the people in the wisdom intensive. I think we have 65 or 70, is that correct? In that intensive. So there are many different things. So I just picked this one to share with you to give a flavor. And so he says, there are five things that are useless. First is no need to, this is Dzogchenpa's admonition. There are five things that are useless. No need to say you're interested in Dharma if you have not turned your mind away from samsara. Well, that's interesting. So, many of us, probably most of the people on this, in the hall today, or on our Zoom meditation hall, would say, yeah, I have an interest in Dharma. I have an interest in the Buddha's teachings and the practices of Dharma. Yeah, that's me. And he says, you shouldn't even say it if you haven't turned your mind away from samsara. So this is a deep teaching. What does that mean for us as lay people? Because we have to understand there's no geographic place called samsara, which is kind of the world of birth and death, the world of becoming. This is the relative world, okay? And there's no other world of nirvana. They're not two different worlds. It's all the same world, same mind. But it's what is our relationship to the things of this world? Is it a samsaric relationship, or is it an enlightened relationship, right? And he's saying, if our mind is still endlessly involved with the things of this world, grasping at them, holding on to them, living for them, always preoccupied by them, right? The ups and downs, the backs and forth, the likes. And, you know, if that's the total consummation of our mind and activities, then he's saying we haven't turned really toward Dharma, because Dharma is the path of liberation from that. Not from those things, but from our attachment, our obsession, our endless rumination about the things of the world, the people of the world, the relationships of the world. You see, it's not these things, it's our, that this is all we see and this is what we're attached to. Of course, this causes us suffering. So he says, so he's encouraging us in this direction. I mean, he's not trying to say, all right, give it up, you know. He's saying, this is what it really means. If you say you are interested in Dharma, then you have to kind of turn away putting all your energy and all your time and attention into these samsaric things, there'll be nothing left over for you really to really develop yourself in Dharma, or you'll always be, you know, back and forth, back and forth. So he's really encouraging us. And again, he's not saying you gotta, you know, give up your job and give up your house and give up your relationships. You know, people go, is that what he's saying? No, he's not saying that. He's saying it's in our mind. Everybody knows their mind. You know, what's my mind up to all day? What's it thinking about all day? What's it concerned about all day? What's it worried about all day? What's it angry about all day? What's it wanting all day? And you might notice it's basically wanting all the things of the world, right? And that is the source of our suffering. And it's preventing us from really transforming and developing the ease and openness, you know, that we really seek. The second, no need to meditate on emptiness if you have not countered attachment to the things you perceive. And then Seishin Gyatso Rinpoche, the one who just did a little annotation on this, he said, one meditates on emptiness in order to release one's clinging because we believe they truly exist. Unless you are free from this, emptiness is no more than a word. So again, for those of you who are newer to Buddhism, the whole idea of emptiness and shunyata might be just like, what are they talking about? And that's fine. But the emptiness of things is really central to the Buddha's realization. And even if one has a real, just an intellectual understanding, it can be very beneficial. It basically is saying, and I think you all know this, that things are empty of any solidity, any selfness, right? That, again, within ourselves, I might be called Fred, but if you did an autopsy on my body mind, you wouldn't find one thing called Fred. You would find thousands and thousands of bodily parts. You would find in the mind consciousness, awareness, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memory. But you wouldn't find anything called Fred. It is empty. Fred is empty of Fredness. It's just a name. This flower is just made up of parts. It wasn't created. It didn't come from a flower just like that. It came from a seed, and that seed came from another plant. It's just a process that's manifested in this moment. There's no such. If again we took this flower and we pulled off all its petals and stem, we wouldn't find anything called a flower. We would just find parts. So this understanding, even intellectually, obviously the best is to have an experiential and enlightened experience of this truth, is very beneficial. Why is it beneficial? Because when one sees that there's nothing really there, then why am I endlessly holding on to things? And this is especially important, the thing like our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our stories. Are they real solid things? Can you take them out and hold them and look at them? You know, if you look into your mind for all your stories, all your narratives about who you are and who you aren't, and you won't find anything solid, will you? And yet we so identify, we so cling. So he's saying, you know, if you think you understand emptiness, if you've been on retreats and other experiences and you think you understand emptiness of things, and yet you still cling, you still grasp, you still endlessly run after, he's saying, forget your meditation on emptiness. Because you haven't use that realization for what it's for. It's not just for having a realization of emptiness. It's to reduce our attachment to things. Why do we want to reduce our attachment to things? Because our attachment to things causes us suffering, and it brings suffering to others. Because we want to be free. We want to be free to be with things or not with things. We want to be free to take things or leave things. We want to be free to be healthy or sick. We want to be free to have people like us or have people dislike us. We want to be free to win and we want to be free to lose. We want to be free to live and we want to be free to die. This is freedom. And to understand the empty nature of things, even to just begin to contemplate on it, is not just something to do in and of itself. There's a purpose behind it in Buddhism, and that is to free us so we can be truly happy. And then the next one, he says, no need to practice meditation if you do not turn your mind away from desires. Now, what does that mean? I say that because everybody, all of us, we all meditate, don't we? And he's saying, no need to practice meditation if you don't turn your mind away from desire. So there's many ways to interpret this. But you might have noticed that when you meditate, is your mind always at peace? Do we find our mind is often agitated? Well, what's agitating it? You see? And to find out what's agitating it, it's not always that we need to look at right at the moment what's agitated, but what keeps our mind agitated all day? In Buddhism, it is said, it is we are endlessly wanting. We're endlessly needing. We want this, we want that, whether it's a thing, whether it's a person, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a lot of people find meditation hard because why? Because when they encounter their mind in meditation, they want a different one. So their meditation is even people's because they're very disturbed because their mind state is not what they want it to be. You know, many people don't like themselves. You may find that hard to believe. Why don't they like themselves? Because they want a different self. Wanting, desiring, right? We wanted a different childhood. We want a different president. We want a different society. We want a different, you see, and there's nothing kind of inherently wrong, except that's the stuff that's keeping our minds stirred up all the time, from morning till night. You know, from the smallest little desires and wanting, needing, you know, to the really big ones that really grab us, that we think essential for my happiness, right? I want this, I must have this, then I'll be happy. Without knowing that it is this wanting and needing and belief that it's only when you get something that you'll be happy is preventing you from being happy right now. Is disturbing my mind right now. So he's saying, please, you know, if you're meditating to develop a calm and stable mind, if you're continuing to keep your mind always endlessly lost in desire, wanting, needing, must have, keeping your mind agitated, you know, don't be surprised that it's difficult to meditate, to concentrate. But we all know this. And the next one, he says, no need for fine words if you have not assimilated the meaning yourself. Yeah, so this is very important, especially for somebody like me who uses fine words all the time. what does he say? No need for fine words if you have not assimilated the meaning yourself. So many of us, we use fine words. Many of us like to talk about spiritual matters, don't we? We talk about it with ourselves. We like to talk about it with others. We like to share about others. you know, we certainly like to give others advice, you know, our wise advice. No need for these fine words if you have not assimilated the meaning yourself. No need to talk about I'm following the Bodhisattva way if really inside I'm really living for myself. Right? No need to talk about I really want to be open-hearted, altruistic. If really all day I'm really just concerned about my own happiness or the end of my own suffering or meeting my own needs. You know, it's very important that we not see Dharma or our spiritual life as a kind of another kind of identity. You see, we all have our egocentric identity, our self-centered identity, and we know where that's like. So many of us, the simplest thing is I'll just get a new identity. I'll create a new identity for myself, right? I'll join the Florida Community of Mindfulness. I'll participate in activities, in retreats, and we will do this. But we really haven't assimilated the meaning, which is really why we're adopting all this, isn't it? Because we want to transform ourselves. You know, we want to realize the potential that all of us have. So he's saying, you know, don't be satisfied with words. We want to penetrate to the meaning of these words. What does it mean to be open-hearted? What does it mean to live selflessly? What does it mean to put others' needs ahead of my own? Right? What does that really mean? When we get the meaning, then we're able to live it. What does it mean to be fearless? What does it mean to really make decisions always for the well-being of others, for the benefit of the majority? So it's interesting. What does that really mean? And then the final one, I want to leave some time for questions. No need to apply the instructions if you do not have devotion. So, you know, for many Americans, when we come to Buddhism, when we come to meditation, when we come to mindfulness, devotion is not a word that is congruent with what we're up to, right? Or maybe not what we're... what we're about. A lot of our involvement in Buddhism and meditation is fairly cerebral. You know, I mean, we understand, we understand where we're stuck. We understand the benefits that'll come from mindfulness and meditation or developing a new view. But it's cerebral. You know what I mean? It's a kind of a cognitive understanding. And then we hear a word like, no need to apply the instructions if you do not have devotion. And devotion is what? Devotion is more of the heart, isn't it? When you're devoted to something, when you're devoted to someone, it's of the heart. I mean, also, which is in Buddhism, heart and mind are the same, but it's a different capacity. It's coming from a different place. When I'm really devoted to something, you can't quantify it like you can like a thought, right? And so that quality of devotion, like in a relationship, you know, if you really have a relationship that you want to nurture, we have to be very devoted to it. If there's a person in our life and we really want to nurture that relation, we have to be devoted to them, right? If we have a skill in life, right? Either a profession or a job or a musical, you know what I mean? Whatever it is, there has to be that level of devotion. Yeah, I really am devoted to this, right? Because I really want to develop myself in this. I'm devoted, you see? And so he's saying, and again, I'm not saying that everybody listening here has to have this level of devotion. I'm just quoting Dzogchenpa and what his advice to us. That if we really want to make progress on the path, this element of devotion is very important, to have some level of devotion. Or else it's very hard for us to stay consistent, right? If we're not really devoted to a person, if we're not really devoted to nurturing a relationship, then our diligence, our discipline, our energy will be fairly weak, or it'll be on and off. In the same way, if really not devoted to whatever endeavor we're doing in life, to our work, or to whatever activity we're doing, if there's not that level of devotion or to a person, we need to ask ourselves, is that quality in me? Am I, especially, again, if our entrance into mindfulness and meditation is primarily therapeutic, which I think it is for many people, and that's fine. I mean, that's certainly acceptable within our community as a very meaningful kind of a reason to enter the Dharma or to take practice, But if one wants to go a little deeper and really look at this as a path of healing and transformation, then, the degree of our devotion to it becomes more important. It's as simple as that. I mean, it's just a very practical thing. So it becomes a self-reflective thing. How important is this to me? How important is this relationship to me? How important is this job skill to me? How important is it to learning this? How devoted am I really? Which means that's where I'm putting my attention and my energy. It comes from devotion, right? How devoted am I to these teachings? How devoted am I to the teachers? I think it's everything that you can understand, we can understand. Because we all know that in anything that's been significant relationship, whether it's a person, a thing, a profession, a job, a skill, without that devotion, that capacity to kind of say, yeah, I'm very devoted to this, so I give this priority in my life, right? It's heartfelt. And so his interest saying, no need to imply the instructions if you do not have the devotion, because again, I think you all know that if we really aren't devoted, then we're in and out. We're back and forth. We're energized, we have no energy. We're interested, who cares? We're always back and forth. But when we have devotion, we have a consistency. And so again, these five things that are, not true practice, right? So Chungpa and these other teachers in this text explain them, I hope none of you going, I don't feel good, This is not a matter of making you feel bad. It's a matter, I say these to the people in this intensive. These teachings are simply mirrors, okay? A mirror is what? A mirror is something that we can see ourselves in. Why do we need a mirror? Because we can't see how we look without a mirror. We might have all ideas how we look, but without looking in a mirror, we don't see. So these teachings are really mirrors. For what? For us to just look at ourselves, to look at our practice. Can we see ourselves more objectively in the light of these teachings, okay? So, I'll read them again and then I'll open to questions. No need to say you're interested in Dharma if you have not turned your mind away from samsara. No need to meditate on emptiness if you've not countered attachment to the things you perceive. No need to practice meditation if you do not turn your mind away from desire. No need for fine words if you've not assimilated the meaning yourself. No need to apply the instructions if you do not have any devotion. So I know we don't have a lot of time, but I'm certainly interested in hearing any of your questions about anything that was said earlier in the OI presentations or my own words or reflecting on this past year and our opening COVID or on these teachings that have been shared from Dzogchenpa. Please chat them in. You all have a chat function on the bottom. Please chat them in to Angie, who will relay them to me. So again, just press on your chat and just put your question in a strong way. Yes, Angie? And by the way, I hope everyone can hear me. Right now, we are in the middle of a storm here. In Tampa, things are blowing and a little noisy. So I hope you all can hear me.
So we do have several questions.
Can you louder?
Let's see if we can make this a little louder. Can you hear me?
No.
Can you hear me in the hall?
No.
Can you hear me in the hall now? Can you hear me in the hall now?
Yeah, now we can.
Okay, good. Okay, the first question, can you please say more about how to have a wholesome desire to be a benefit to others, build Sangha, protect our precious planet, and so on, without experiencing the klesha of desire?
Without what?
Without experiencing the klesha of desire.
Well, again, so I think everybody heard the question. Actually, in Buddhist teaching, this realm, the human realm, there are many other realms, but this human realm, it is called the realm of desire. For those who've wondered why you have desires from morning till night, this is the human realm. We are a bundle of desires. Okay? Why is that? Because of our mistakenness of seeing the objects of our mind, the objects of awareness, as something outside ourselves, right? And so we think that if I get those things that I desire, that look pleasant to me, things, people, relationships, experience, pleasures, and if I get rid of all the ones that don't, right, then I'll be happy. So we live in the realm of desire. We all have desires. Is that clear? Right? So, understanding that, how can we acknowledge that desire is within us already and change the things we are desiring? Such as, I desire to move my life in an altruistic way. That's my desire. My desire is to be helpful to the people I live with. My desire is to be helpful to the people I work with. My desire is to be helpful to the world. My personal desire is to free myself of all my suffering and my delusions so I can fulfill my desire to be of benefit to others. I'm just using this as an example, is that we can look at the world within us of desire and look at all the things that we desire all day and really objectively go, is that really helping me? Is that really making me happy? Is that really fulfilling, you know, my aspirations in this life? Or can I use this human capacity for desire to start desiring things that will really pay off in the way that I want? You see? So having a strong desire to be free of suffering can be very beneficial. To have a strong desire to truly be happy, not in the momentary way that pleasures or getting what we want gives us, you know, for a half an hour or a day or a week, but we say, no, I really want to feel a continuous sense of happiness and well-being. That's a good desire. So it's not about having to, you know, repress desire. It's really having clarity and discernment that we can look at, you know, how desire functions within us and really see clearly that there's a whole bunch of desires that only create trouble, that only disturb my mind, that only keep me agitated, that only produce, unwholesome feelings within me. It's those desires that we need to liberate ourselves from and replace them by healthy desires. You know, like, how about, I want to have a healthy body. That's my desire. That's a good desire, right? I want to have a healthy mind. So just good desire. I want to have a mind that has filled with love and caring and openness and patience and generosity. That's a good desire. Okay. Thank you. Next.
How do you balance devotion and life?
Well, again, I think I sort of just said it. We are lay people. So to practice Dharma, we don't go off to a monastery. We don't go off somewhere. We don't go off to the mountains. We practice in life. So the answer is, we got to ask ourselves, if I look at my mind, what am I really devoted to in this life? You know, so one can be totally, you know, in all the activities in my life, I'm devoted to cultivating mindfulness and awareness. No matter what I'm doing, this is what I'm devoted to, right? You know, I'm devoted to developing myself in Dharma, developing myself in meditation. I'm very devoted to this. So I give time in my life to practice. I give time in my life to study, right? I'm very devoted to bringing happiness to the people that I'm involved with in this life. One manifests devotion, healthy devotion, in the midst of one's life. We are lay people. Let me just say it again. We practice in life, right? That has meaning. Everybody, that has a different meaning. It's like wherever we are in life, whatever we're doing, whoever we're involved in, this is where we manifest Dharma. If we think we only manifest Dharma, our devotion to Dharma when we come to meditation or we come to the meditative hall or we, you know, listen to, you know, a Zoom call or whatever, that could be a manifestation of your devotion to healing and transforming yourself. But the devotion can go on all the time. You know, if you really are devoted to someone, that devotion doesn't disappear when you don't see them, does it? You know, it's always in your heart, even if you're not with them, because as soon as something comes up in relationship to them, you very positively respond to them because you're devoted to them. Is that clear? So this is very important that we understand that we our devotion can manifest in the midst of our life. Maybe we'll take one more.
What is the difference between devotion and attachment to a person or a view? How does one decide what they truly want then without that desire leading to suffering?
Yeah, well, that's the key piece. The key piece in Buddhism is attachment. So this is, you know, 2,600 years, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, every teacher, anywhere. Yeah, attachment is the key piece, right? That's to be attached is to be stuck. So we don't give up our relationships. We don't give up our loves. We don't give up all the things that are meaningful to us, but we're not attached to them because we know they're empty. They're not solid or real or stable. Everything is changing. Everything is impermanent. Everything is unfolding according to causes and conditions, including my own heart and mind. So I'm not attached to things always being a certain way. There's great freedom in that, right? So it's, excuse me. Frightened that I am well vaccinated and don't be concerned. What was the question again? What? Yeah. So attachment, yeah. So again, it is not life that we need to give up. It is not the things of life that we need to give up. I mean, unless we want to, unless we really see they're not healthy or they're a diversion, you know what I'm saying? But things in themselves are not the problem. Things are just things, you know? Bodies are just bodies. Things are just things. Relationships are, you know, people are just people, right? There's nothing inherently desirous in any of that, right? Right, you may look at somebody and go, wow, I really desire him or her, you know, but if it was a pig looked at them, they wouldn't desire them, would they? Right? Or somebody else, you know, you might be over going, ooh, I really desire this. Somebody else is over looking and going, I have no desire for that. Oh, but I really have desire for this. Now, why is that? Because things in and themselves, there's nothing desirous about them. They're just things. Desire, attachment comes from the mind. That's where attachment, aversion, like, dislike, wanting, needing, grasping, these are all in the mind. It is the mind that needs to be freed of these things, right? So we can freely move through life. You know, we want to be free. We want to be able to freely move in the world of liking and disliking and desire and people and things and freely respond and, you know, without attachment. Because if there's attachment, there's aversion. If I want something, then I don't want its opposite. And to live in the world of attachment and aversion is always to live in the world where the mind is ill at ease, where the mind is always stirred up with emotionality. We have to understand that the source of our problem is not the world. The source of all our problems and issues is our own mind. I mean, that's like fundamental to Buddhism. We turn and we go, yeah, the cause of my suffering lies within my own mind. That's where it is. So that's easy. I don't have to transform and change everybody in the world. See, that was hard. I need to transform my own mind. And if I transform my own mind, I will transform my heart. And if I transform my mind and heart, I will be at ease. And I will be open-hearted. And I will be all the things that I want. It's all right here. But, you know, we have to have all these other things. We have to have devotion. We have to have application. We have to have consistency, you know. Anyhow, I can see it's getting on to the bewitching hour. So I hope you enjoyed the Dharma talk today and it was of some benefit to you.